Good morning. This meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee will come to order. Today is Thursday, March 17th, 2022. The time is 8:06 a.m. Members currently present are Representative Drummond, Representative Brox, Representative McCarty, Representative McCabe, Co-Chair Shragi, and myself, Representative Hannon. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to thank our House Records Secretary, Lori Rowland, and our LIO moderator, Talia Ames, for assisting the committee this morning. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence your cell phones. Today we will take up two bills, House Bill 298, creating the Alaska Food Strategy Task Force, and House Bill 256, related to law enforcement and reporting use of force. Representative Snyder, would you like to make remarks before we go to your invited speakers? We'll invite Representative Snyder and her staff, Ms. Wiggin, if she wants to join us. Put yourselves on the record and give us any opening comments prior to us going to your invited testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Co-Chair Shragi and members of the committee for allowing us to come back and hear from invited and public testimony today. Just simply wanted to highlight, I think at this point we have about 22 letters of support broadly representing the variety of interests in the Alaska food system. Simply wanted to highlight, it appears on basis we just noticed this morning that the Alaska Farm Bureau letter of support looks like it uploaded blank, but we have it here and can distribute copies and we'll make sure basis gets updated. Thank you.
All right. Anything? Representative McCabe.
I appreciate that, Madam Co-Chair. So it's one of the things I noticed this morning, that there was a lack of sort of farmers and growers and the beginning of food security on the sponsor statement. So I would love to see more of those, even the Farm Bureau, but even more from farmers if you have any contacts.
Go ahead.
It'd be great just to read their ideas. You get a lot, I think, from the letters, the people that are interested in it. There's lots of good ideas in there. So anyways, thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. And we'll keep uploading them and sending them to your office as they come in.
All right. We do have both invited testimony and it looks like a couple people on public testimony, but we're going to start with Robbie Mixon, the Executive Director of the Alaska Food Policy Council. Robbie, can you hear us? And if you can, you're going to put yourself on the record and give your testimony this morning.
Hi, I can hear you. Can you guys hear me?
We can. Please go ahead.
Hi. Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. My name is Robbie Mixon, and I'm calling in from Homer. Today, I'm representing the Alaska Food Policy Council, where I've served as the first ever executive director for the last 2.5 years, and as a board member for 2 years prior to that. The Alaska Food Policy Council is a nonprofit organization committed to making improvements in Alaska's food system. Over 175 agencies and individuals representing federal and state agencies, tribal and city schools, universities, farmers, fisheries, and all points in the food system are represented by AFPC. And our goal is to create a healthier, more secure, more self-reliant Alaska by improving our food system. And this is also a really opportune moment to hear testimony about House Bill 298. In just 1 hour, we're launching our 6th Alaska Food Festival and Conference, which happens every 18 months. And our 2022 edition is our biggest to date with over 70 sessions, workshops, and panels. So though we're small in staff, like I mentioned, we're just one part-time employee, we are mighty in our reach. AFPC maintains several statewide working groups like the Food Waste Committee and the Indigenous Foods Working Group. And in 2020, we received a USDA Regional Food System Partnership grant called Growing Connections and Building Networks for Greater Alaskan Food Security. It aims to connect localized food system organizations by creating a network of regional nodes through direct facilitation. Each node was guided through a series of planning discussions, including community and regional-based asset mapping to identify unique capacities in those areas for local food systems while looking at barriers and system deficiencies. The project considers perspectives from hyper-local through borough and state level and utilizes a systems approach to food security planning. By looking at how all the parts are connected throughout the food system, we're hoping to identify ways to leverage assets. So I mentioned this because this plan can help inform the work of the task force. So helping translate our broad policy recommendations into tangible policies and regulations for our state. The Food Policy Council is capable of providing support and structure should this task force be created. And if we have the honor of participating in it, we've been training and preparing for this for over a decade. This USDA-funded project, along with our original research that we've worked on and contracted, our committee activities, our outreach, and our convening capabilities can directly support and complement the work of an Alaska Food Strategy Task Force, along with the work being conducted or to be conducted by Governor Dunleavy's Food Security Task Force that's forming in the next couple weeks. We commend the governor's administrative order and view House Bill 298 as a continuation of the work ahead of us, and will provide more time and increased stakeholder input in order to achieve economic independence and self-sufficiency. This has to be an ongoing, long-term, and collective effort. The past 2 years have revealed more clearly than ever the tremendous lack of food security within our state. We have tremendous challenges ahead of us, but we truly believe that this proposed task force can help to lay the groundwork to transform our food system into a more localized, inclusive, equitable, and sustainable one that creates long-lasting jobs for Alaskans. Through the collaboration of stakeholders across Alaska's food system, recommendations on policy programs and investments can help this. We are in full support of House Bill 298, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Mixon. Next up, we have Amy Seitz, Executive Director of the Alaska Farm Bureau. Amy, if you can hear us, put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, and hopefully you can hear me okay.
Perfect. Go ahead.
Well, thank you for taking testimony on House Bill 298 this morning. For the record, my name is Amy Seitz. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Farm Bureau, as well as the current Chair for the Alaska Food Policy Council. And I'm wearing both hats today on this bill, because both organizations believe that we really need to build a resilient food system and a comprehensive strategy with everyone at the table to do that. So Alaska's food system has been very reliant on outside sources for far too long. We rely on production, processing, and manufacturing of food in other states and countries. We rely on a workforce in other areas. We rely on long-distance shipping, and all the while we hope that there are no major breakdowns in that system. And this reliance has made us very vulnerable, and as well as missing economic benefits of having a robust food system. And we've seen time and time again our food supply get disrupted and our grocery store shelves go bare, whether it's earthquakes, dock worker strikes in other states. So we've seen impact from the disruptions in the supply chain. Until the pandemic, these things have always kind of resolved themselves fairly quickly, and the food supply chain gets back to normal. And when I say normal, I mean Alaskans spending nearly $2 billion out of state from purchasing imported foods. With the pandemic, the supply chain hasn't returned to normal. There continue to be empty shelves. I know we've all seen it more than we have before. The price of food has been rising, and you know we're going to continue to see the price come up. There's global issues happening right now that are increasing inputs for producing food. So right now is the prime time to have a collaborative effort in shaping the strategy to build a robust food system for Alaska. And it needs to be collaborative with all the various sectors of the food system working together. We can't build a food system with each sector kind of working in a silo. And that's how we've been doing it in the past. So it's kind of like if everyone there in the committee room was working on a puzzle and each of you had your own 10 pieces to put together and you work by yourself. We're never going to have a complete puzzle. One of you is working on production, another one working on developing markets, someone else is working on the transportation pieces. We're never going to have that complete puzzle done until everyone comes together. And I know, as Representative McCabe has brought up before, the transportation system is a very important part of food security, and that needs to be looked at. We need a reliable transportation system for on- and off-road communities. And I know right now, our farmers, with the increased gas prices, if we can find efficiencies so they maybe don't spend as much every day in the gas inputs, that would kind of bring the cost of food down. So, with more efficient ways to transport equipment and supplies, and then also getting that food product moved around the state through the market. And while transportation is a key part of the food system, if we only focus on that and not increasing production, not developing markets, we'll still remain food insecure and reliant on other states. And we won't capture that $2 billion that leaves the state from food purchases. So this task force, set up in House Bill 298, will bring the experts from the various sectors of the food system to the table. And I know all the different organizations, Food Policy Council, Farm Bureau, Farmers Market Association, we've been making an effort to be more collaborative. I think one key element that the task force in House Bill 298 brings to the table is buy-in from the state. We need the agencies at the table. We need the legislators at the table, along with all the experts from the different sectors of the food system. So I think that's definitely a key part of this task force, to build a robust food system. And I think with that, I'm happy to move on to the next testimony or answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Seitz. I don't see anybody seeking to give you a question, so we thank you for actually, Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Ms. Seitz. Just wondering how the Farm Bureau event in Palmer went last night, which I missed.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative McCabe, thanks for bringing that up. I was actually in Palmer last night for the Matthew Chapter Farm Bureau meeting. It went really well. We had a lot of farmers in the room, and we talked about this bill. So I'll make sure we get some more farmer input to you.
Thank you.
But yeah, it was a great event.
Great.
And a late night for me.
Okay. I was going to say, it says you're calling in from Soldotna. So you made the drive from Palmer to Soldotna. I assume that meant you were dodging moose somewhere on that drive. Glad that you made it safely.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Representative Prox, you have a question from the site?
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. Yeah, through the chair, I'm sure you have a presence in the interior of the Fairbanks North Pole area. I'm wondering who that contact person is.
Through the chair, Representative Peck, I do, and actually the Fairbanks chapter of the Farm Bureau will be having their meeting in April, and I hope to go up for that. I don't know if Fritz Wozniak is the current chapter president for the Fairbanks chapter. And I can always get you his contact information if you would like.
If you would, please, yes.
All right. Again, thank you, Ms. Seitz. It sounds like you had a late night and an early morning, so glad you're with us. We have one more invited testimony, Tekin Galbraith. So we'll go to Tekin next with the Intertribal Agriculture Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tekin Galbraith. I am from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm calling in representing Intertribal Agriculture, the Technical Assistance Specialist. The Intertribal Council was founded in 1987 to pursue and promote the conservation, development, and use of our agriculture resources for the betterment of our people. We recognize land-based agriculture resources are vital to the economic and social welfare of many Native American and Alaskan tribes, that the harmonies of man, soil, water, air, vegetation, and wildlife that collectively make up the American Indian agriculture community influence our emotional and spiritual being. Prior to 1987, American Indian agriculture was basically unheard of outside of reservation boundaries. And since that time, IAC has grown to prominence in Indian country and among the federal government agencies in the agriculture field with which it works on behalf of individual Indian producers and tribal enterprises. The IAC has, over three decades, become a recognized as the most respected voice within the Indian community and government circles on agriculture policies and programs in Indian country. We are being shown by global events that now more than ever we must address the food insecurity and bring it local. I recently stumbled across the quote from Eula Bliss where she said, "The garden in which we work when we are no longer optimistic is not a retreat from the world, but a place where we cultivate the world." This idea gives me hope. It is a sentiment that I, as well as the organization I work for, have been working on for decades. There is possibility for reform and opportunity to recreate and develop just and equitable systems that invest in human lives and all the relationships that we keep. Relations to our community, the land, to the animals, and with ourselves. At the foundation of all of these relationships, food is a catalyst for health. Intertribal Agriculture Council recognizes the interconnectedness of this challenge, and as a result, we as a tribal nonprofit invest our time and energy in a diverse array of services and programs. Part of IAC's work is the program that my position is funded under, the National Technical Assistance Network. We have a technical assistance specialist in each of the DIA regions to support tribes and tribal producers accomplish their goals related to food sovereignty and food security. Within this work, we offer free technical assistance to meet harvesters, ranchers, and farmers wherever they are at and work with them to remove barriers, identify solutions, and support their individual or community vision. I think it is important to reconcile with the fact that there is no going back, only forward. Fortunately, Alaska has a unique position. In many cases, infrastructure has yet to be built. In doing so, we can imagine the future that we want to see rather than limit ourselves to how to change what exists already. All through small-scale, community-focused efforts, in partnership with support from statewide advocacy, planning, and infrastructure development, we have the opportunity to develop a resilient and robust food system that not only feeds us, but also brings us closer together and reduces our contribution to the global carbon footprint. Indigenous communities manage vast amounts of land and resources throughout the world, while unwelcome government and private industry interventions have significantly reduced the native homelands in the United States. 59 million acres remain under native management. A vast majority of these resources are utilized for food and agriculture production purposes. In Alaska, collectively, Alaska Native people are the largest landholders in the state. In most cases, the land was selected by individual tribes and Alaska Native corporations were chosen based on traditional uses and availability of food resources. In my work, I have not had a single conversation with any individual or tribe who does not value the ability to continue practicing our traditional ways of life while also ensuring the food security of their community. What does that look like? It's annual fish harvest from rivers and oceans that provide for us. It's gallons and gallons of berries put up and preserved for winter. It's caribou hunts, moose hunts, it is whale hunts. It is community gardens and greenhouses. It is the revitalization of traditional youth areas. It is sharing of our resources and bounty to ensure that no one goes hungry. By activating and empowering native holistic regenerative ways of producing food and agriculture ways, we can inspire and inform a worldwide movement that will make a significant impact on our food security for the state. So I ask you this. If Alaska food-related products, activities, and ways of life disappear from our state, would you still want to live here? If no blueberries were to be found while we're walking through the sweet, spicy smell of tundra, your garden harvest didn't grow beyond belief under the long summer sun, or if your hands never again held the sparkling scales of salmon while you were thanking it for its life, would this still feel like home to you? If the answer is no, then I encourage you to find a way in your own life to engage even more in Alaska's diverse and unique food system and make it more resilient and inclusive. House Bill 298 is a meaningful step that we can take to accomplish this goal by encouraging bipartisan and cross-sectorial considerations to design and create a food system that is not only resilient, but thriving. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Tikan. Anyone? All right. I did, just before I go to Representative McCabe, I request, I think that Ms. Seitz and Ms. Mixon and Mr. Galbraith, if you could submit your testimony in writing, there's at least one member who would like to see that. It appeared that you had a nice write-up. Representative McCabe, you had a question.
Thanks. Yeah. So, Mr. Galbraith, one of the things that I think we all need to be very interested in Alaska is the old ways of storing food, especially the native ways. We talk all the time in different food security venues about refrigerated storage and how we're going to store the food that we envision that we're going to produce or collect. And, I suspect that the natives in Alaska had ways of doing that centuries before we ever arrived here. So I wonder if that could be part of the consideration of what you're doing is finding those ways that could be easily multiplied into, instead of just storing a couple gallons of berries, say, storing a couple hundred gallons of berries. That's just one example, but I talked to a family member who is a native and asked, how did you store moose back when you were growing up? And he said, we didn't. We just hung it up, and when we wanted a piece, we would go carve it off, and we would trim off the rotten pieces, and it was the most tender moose you've ever had. So who knew? I thought it always had to be frozen or preserved somehow. And so anyways, those kinds of things I think we would all be interested in. And the task force as well. So maybe just not really a question, but just something for you to think about.
I appreciate the comments, and I think looking to our traditional sciences that existed, traditional ecological knowledge within our communities, our tribal communities and tribal members, is an important step to finding meaningful solutions to the challenges that we're facing globally and as a state.
Thanks.
I agree. Thank you.
All right. With that, we're going to open public testimony. And we have a few people signed up online. And we'll start with Sharon Stephen Ganser of the He Will Provide Food Pantry. If you will put yourself on the record, and then you can proceed.
Thank you. My name is Sharon Stevens Ganser. I live in Seward, Alaska. I'm representing He Will Provide Food Pantry in Seward. We began in 2007. A group of people decided that they wanted to help out with food insecurity in Seward. So the program started in 2007. We became a 501c3 at that time. Last year, the food pantry, He Will Provide Food Pantry distributed I lost my note. Just a second. We distributed 21,755 pounds of food to over 2,800 households. This is throughout the whole year, and we served 336 different people with the food pantry. This trend seems to be continuing for this year. So food insecurity in Seward is a real thing. We would like to let the state know that this is happening all over the state, not just in Seward. So I would like you to consider developing House Bill 298, the task force. If you have any questions, I'm here to answer.
Thank you, Ms. Ganser. I have one question just to make sure I understand, and this is Rep. Hannon, your numbers. You said 2,800 households and 336 individuals. So are those individuals in addition to the households, or are they part of those households?
I would keep track every week of the households that came in. So there were 336 different people that used the food pantry last year. So throughout the year, that counted as 2,800 households.
Okay.
That meaning that the 336 people came back several different times.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for taking – Representative Drummond has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Scanson, for your work. Yeah, I'm a little confused by the 2,800 households because Seward only has about 3,000 population. I'm not sure that's a
That number means that those 336 different people that came in several different times throughout the year. So they came back and utilized the food pantry. They were different households. Not different households, but there were the 336 different people came back that many times throughout the year.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Ganser. Next is Rachel Miller with the Alaska Food Policy Council.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
We can. Go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Excellent. Good morning. For the record, my name is Rachel Miller. I'm a resident of Anchorage. Thank you to the committee for holding this hearing on House Bill 298. So I'm calling in as an Alaska transplant. I am not from here, but I am someone who chose to come here, like so many, because of opportunity. And I sit on the board of the Alaska Food Policy Council, and I'm an associate professor of business at Alaska Pacific University, where I also manage our 800-acre Kellogg Farm campus in Palmer. I've worked in food security on a variety of projects in Alaska, Colorado, Ohio, and West Africa, and I chose to land in Alaska because of the opportunities that exist in the circumpolar north for innovative food production and technology development. So we often say up here that if we can grow, process, and store it in Alaska, we can do it on Mars, making Alaska a pretty attractive site for globally relevant food entrepreneurs. So my thinking is that investing in food security is not only a discussion about scarcity, but about opportunity, growth, and innovation leadership in the north, which I believe is much bigger than the $2 billion we often cite as the amount of money we spend out of state purchasing food alone. In mid-February, I had the opportunity to present opportunities for food systems investment to the Alaska Food and Farm Caucus, and that same day, Governor Dunleavy released Administrative Order 331 to establish the Alaska Food Security and Independence Task Force. This was great. Food is a wonderfully bipartisan topic, and it really is encouraging to see such efforts from both the administration and the legislature. Furthermore, it's been greatly humbling to see the hyper-localized efforts that have sprung up across the state, especially since the 2018 earthquake and throughout the COVID-19 global pandemic. And this includes everything from seed sharing to canning classes to food network building across the state. But much of this work continues to happen in silos, as my colleague Amy Seitz from the Farm Bureau just detailed. Often, critically, this separates disaster preparedness and long-term investment in food systems, which is a critical and potentially seriously life-threatening gap that we continue to avoid in the state. We know we need investment as soon as yesterday in our entire food web to support cultural celebration and sustained access to traditional foods for Alaska Native communities, reliable transportation to and around Alaska for goods, including our ailing Anchorage port, climate-controlled food storage, workforce development adequate, I emphasize that term, adequate funding for cooperative extension services and investment in agricultural education and research funding, as well as incentives for farmers to launch and grow. Now, I'm sure many of you are familiar that there are already well-researched reports out there about food systems improvement by the Alaska Food Policy Council, by UAA's Institute of Social and Economic Research. UAF has many food-related initiatives, and there are a variety of consulting groups who have issued reports. And as Robbie Mixon mentioned a few minutes ago, statewide network development has begun under the Alaska Food Policy Council's recent USDA-funded project called Growing Connections and Building Networks for Greater Food Security. This project will result in a 10-year food systems action plan due out this fall, and we look forward to making this report publicly accessible for all and hope that it will aid in reducing the burden of just one group or one sector of our government to create this, our roadmap to food security. And so if all of these reports exist, we know the research has been done. Why haven't they been activated yet? And why haven't we solved this puzzle of food security in Alaska? Especially knowing that we used to produce 55% of food consumed in state, which is now down to just an estimated 5%. The issue is often how we go about this and how we make these investments and how we leverage federal dollars to maximize impact and value for the state. I believe that House Bill 298 is a piece of this puzzle and will model state buy-in, as we've seen in other, especially the seafood industry, for food security. House Bill 298 is inclusive, and it's a timely bill. It's written such that it is well-positioned to pick up where the governor's task force of food security will leave off this fall when it's scheduled to close and report out. And so in closing, as someone with over 15 years in food security experience in a variety of locations, I strongly endorse House Bill 298 as a way to capitalize on the current momentum and interest we're seeing globally in food security, and as a channel to further highlight economic development, potentially leverage federal dollars coming in, and decrease reliance on outside resources. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. I don't see anyone seeking your attention, so thank you for coming to join us this morning. Next up is Melissa Martin, president of the Anchor Point Food Pantry.
Hello. Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee for accepting my call. I'm from Anchor Point, which is the southern peninsula, Kenai Peninsula, and we want to express our support for House Bill 298. We are a rural area, and we have an extreme lack of food. We don't have stores or any ways of acquiring food in an easy manner. But we do hear often of food that gets wasted. I love that tribal person that has spoke saying how they put up food, and we would love to learn that kind of thing and love to teach it from the pantry. So it would be wonderful to get that information here. We need a task force such as this. I personally have heard of commercial fishermen that have had to throw fish back into the ocean that wouldn't survive due to the laws that are in place now. And we would just love to get some of that fish. It would be a shame. But I want to make my statement simple, and I thank you for hearing my statement.
And Melissa, can you put your name on the record? So just formally tell us your name, please.
Okay. Melissa Martin. President of the Anchor Point Food Pantry.
Thank you. Anyone? All right. Thank you, Ms. Martin, for taking the time to be with us this morning. Next up is Ron Meehan, Policy and Advocacy Manager, Food Bank of Alaska, and Manager of the Alaska Food Coalition. So go ahead and put your name and association on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Can everybody hear me?
We can.
Perfect. My name is Ron Meehan, and I am representing the Food Bank of Alaska as Policy and Advocacy Manager and the Alaska Food Coalition as Manager. Both are statewide organizations and work with partners across Alaska's food system. The Alaska Food Coalition consists of more than 160 partners from every corner of Alaska, representing food banks and pantries, state agencies, tribal councils, faith-based organizations, and more. And I'm here to testify in favor of HB 298. This bill will allow Alaska to develop a comprehensive food policy strategy to strengthen our food system, reduce food insecurity, and grow our local food economies. And it's something that food security advocates from across the state have been working towards for quite some time. Alaskans face unique challenges to food production and maintaining access to healthy and nutritious foods due to our geographic isolation and the distance between our communities. The food bank network in Alaska has seen an unprecedented level of food insecurity since the start of the pandemic. So to put that in numbers, the Food Bank of Alaska distributed 8,077,852 pounds of food in 2019. That number rose in 2020 and continued to rise in 2021, reaching over 11 million pounds of food for 1 year. So the difference is nearly 3 million pounds more food a year since the start of the pandemic. We anticipate continuing to see elevated levels of need for quite some time as families are still trying to get back on their feet. Finding solutions to overcome these barriers will require research and collaboration among stakeholders of Alaska's food system from across the state, and focusing policy and implementation recommendations on sustainably growing the agricultural industry, improving efficiencies in state-run programs, and ensuring food security in rural and urban communities is something that really stands to substantially benefit all Alaskans. So the formation of a robust food strategy task force stands to greatly enhance Alaska's food system. We're enthusiastic supporters of HB 298, and I thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. I don't have anyone seeking to quiz you this morning. You are a regular communicator with most members of the legislature, so thank you for your continued advocacy. Next up is Claire Lubick, St. Francis House Food Pantry Program, Director of Catholic Social Services. Go ahead and put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Claire Lepke. I'm the program director at St. Francis House Food Pantry. It's the largest and oldest food pantry in Anchorage, and it's one of seven programs of Catholic Social Services. And we are based in Anchorage, which is also where I grew up. I went to elementary school all through university in Anchorage, so it's home. And I'm so happy that you guys gave us the time to speak on behalf of House Bill 298 this morning. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. So through our work at Catholic Social Services, we really understand how food insecurity negatively impacts the lives of those we serve, and that the need for improved food systems is really great. St. Francis House Food Pantry works to address this need directly, along with our partners across the state doing similar work, and our important partner, Food Bank of Alaska. We provided food to over 10,000 unique households last year alone. In February, just last month, we saw 884 unique households. We served them with 1,360 visits, and that represents 2,353 individuals who saw food from our food pantry just last month. CSS's Refugee Assistance and Immigration Services Program also works to address food insecurity in Anchorage through agricultural programming, including operation of the municipality's largest urban farm. We're working to strengthen local food systems, provide fresh and locally grown produce to underserved neighborhoods, and provide clients with the opportunity to become food entrepreneurs. We are seeing the positive impact that this type of programming has on our community at a local scale, and would love to see a focus on these types of initiatives across the state through a task force like the one proposed by House Bill 298. As an agency, CSS has a vested interest in both food production and food access, as well as a deep understanding that food security initiatives are essential to the stability of vulnerable people in communities across our state. On behalf of Catholic Social Services and our Board of Trustees, I want to express our support for House Bill 298. We appreciate the robust committee representation and the comprehensive food security categories that are outlined by this legislation. We agree with our partners in the Alaska Food Coalition that the creation of a food strategy task force is the best way to establish a priority agenda for food security across our state. Thank you so much for your time, and please reach out with any questions.
And again, Ms. Lubke, I don't see anyone seeking to actually, Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Claire. I'm sorry, I didn't get your last name straight. You mentioned something about the largest local farm in the municipality. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the Refugee Assistance and Immigration Services Program partners with the Anchorage Community Land Trust to run Grow North Farm in Mountain View. It's the largest farm within the urban farm within the municipality, and it serves as a platform for refugee-owned agricultural and food businesses. So they grow and sell food on the property as well, or grow and sell produce on the property as well as sell hot foods during the summer. And also part of the agricultural programming within the Refugee Assistance Program, they run a co-op farm called Fresh International Gardens, which is also located in Mountain View. And that serves as a job training program for newly arrived refugees who are not ready to enter the workforce.
Okay, great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have shopped at the Grow North Farm many times, and I think it's an amazing resource for Anchorage and for employing refugees. It's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think there's a lot of opportunity and initiatives like that for vulnerable people across the state. So thank you for your support.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. Through the chair, I'm intrigued that you're employing somebody to grow food. That seems to be where the difficult part is. Is that a self-sustaining operation, or are there subsidies coming in to keep it going?
Sure. I think to get the program up and running, there is funding through refugee resettlement at a federal level for this type of programming, and we have received two rounds of funding through USDA refugee agriculture grants. But I can get you the figures. The co-op farm earned $22,000 last year, over $22,000, and people are paid out not from the grant but from the produce that is sold. There's only one paid position facilitating those programs, and last year, there was 14 clients engaged just in that program alone. There's also, from Grow North Farm, the refugee-owned businesses, I believe there's five of them, they all are paid from what they produce. So there's no subsidy going to the pay rate of those people. Those aren't businesses.
Okay. Well, it'd be interesting to follow up on that. Thank you.
Please. My email is blubke@cssalaska.org.
Ms. Lubke, it would be helpful if you sent that to the committee in writing, and then we'll share it with everyone on the committee.
Thank you for your interest. Will do.
All right. Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, I definitely appreciate receiving that. I have constituents that are very much with the work of Catholic Social Services, but do bring up questions of, and they definitely appreciate the work of helping, humanity, but bring up questions of are we sustaining the people coming in by giving them opportunities of a workforce in their jobs? Or are we creating a situation where Catholic Social Services brings people in and then puts it on the state to take care of the people from that point on, and they're kind of stuck in a care system from that point? So to see the sustainability of your program and what is actually being paid out and what's being sustained for people that are employed in overseeing that too, that's a good question. So appreciate receiving that information.
sure. I think you bring up some concerns that are typical of the overall refugee resettlement process. But I think you'll be happy to see the numbers that I can provide you, that these are small both businesses that are completely self-sustaining, and these people are creating their own value in their lives.
Thank you. All right, I don't have anyone else online. I'm confirming with our LIO moderator that that's the extent of our public testimony online, and I am checking around the room to make sure there is no one here to give in-person testimony. So I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 298. Ms. Wiggin, Rep. Snyder, that brings us back to you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just before we close out here and I wrap up my remarks, I did want to circle back to a comment made by one of our invited testifiers, Rachel Miller, another Alaska Food Policy Council board member and a business professor who also manages the APU farm out in Palmer. And she made an excellent point that doesn't get raised often enough, but we often hear about the $2 billion that Alaskans spend on food that's brought up, that we could be spending on food that's produced here. But I think that is the very lowest amount in our potential, because that does not include additional food system development opportunities and what type of revenue that can generate and the economic potential that provides, whether we're talking about new value-added products. I had the opportunity to attend an international food conference in Finland a couple years ago, and just seeing the range of food products that we don't see here created in the circumpolar environment was really inspiring, whether we're talking about innovative food science technologies, urban production methodologies, or export potential, which I know a lot of folks get excited about. All of those things would add on top of that $2 billion that we hear a lot about. And lastly, I think we heard some really great ideas for some friendly amendments when we did our intro hearing earlier this week, and I just wanted to extend the invitation from my office to discuss those with you. And if you would like connections with any of our stakeholders or throughout our network, we would be happy to connect you or point you in a helpful direction.
With that, I'll make sure the committee knows that our intention is to set the bill aside today, have an amendment deadline of next Wednesday, March 23rd, and that we'll be, we're having Department of Corrections next week. We know their presentation question, we're anticipating that's going to take the full meeting on Tuesday. We're not sure if it'll be the full meeting on Thursday. So we'll have 298 sort of fluttering in the wind if there is room to take it up on Thursday. So that's why the amendment deadline will be Wednesday to come back to it. And if we don't get to it on that Thursday, then we'll see it the following week.
At what time?
I think standardly we've been doing 4 p.m. Anything else on 298? All right. Thank you, Representative Snyder, Ms. Wiggin. Thank you for being with us this morning. A passionate topic that I think everyone wants to be engaged in, and everybody's wheels are turning.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm excited to know about the farm in Muldoon. I do frequent Anchorage usually during the summer and make a lot of farmers market stops. But I did not know about Grow North Farm, and I am curious to see what interesting and different produce there is.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Liz.
All right, next up, we will turn to House Bill 256 related to law enforcement and use of force reporting. We did not receive any amendments for the bill. We'll invite Representative Tarr and her staff, Mr. Song, back to the table.
Is he happy?
You're always so happy.
I try.
By your office in the morning just to see your smile.
We should note Representative Tarr lives with a happy dog that she brings with her, and so, you know, no matter what, I'm sure that dog in the morning insists that you give him some undivided happy time.
Long walks, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, there's just a few handouts going out that we thought would be helpful relative to conversations. One of them is a handout from the FBI about exactly what data they collect, and Ms. Howell has been referencing this particular document during the question and answer period of prior committee hearings. And then a second document is the list of the 21 agencies that are currently participating and submitting their information to the FBI. So that represents about 80% of law enforcement professionals in the state of Alaska. So through the legislation, we would be including the remaining 20% that could report into the FBI use of force system. And then the third is just the definitions that Ms. Howell had referred to that are referred to in House Bill 256. So hopefully those are helpful to answer some of those questions that came out of the last hearing. And of course, we're available for any other questions, as is the staff from Department of Corrections and Department of Public Safety.
Any questions? We have both the department and the sponsor here with us. Representative Fox?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. I don't recall if it was a gentleman calling in this committee hearing, but I've heard complaints from actually former law enforcement officers and the gentleman called in, a few others, that the system is already fairly burdened down with paperwork and reporting. And it would seem that this is going to add to that. And then I worked with quite a few, actually, retired law enforcement officers that were security on for the company that I worked for. So I'm concerned about that. And then in the job that I had over time, we got more and more and more reporting requirements, not law enforcement. This was equipment maintenance. And it gets from the boots on the ground level, it gets discouraging, frankly, that some system is looking over your shoulder all the time, and everybody over time became hesitant to do anything for fear of doing something wrong. Are we exacerbating that problem with this particular project?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, I really appreciate that question. I think it's an important consideration because of what an important job our law enforcement professionals have. And I can think of a few ways to respond, and then perhaps Jennifer, who is with the department, could come up and Lisa, pardon me. Sorry about that. That's embarrassing. Pardon me. Could come up, who actually deals with the actual input of the data. But a few things to say to that. One, the list that we provided you are all of the law enforcement agencies that are voluntarily participating, and that represents about 80% of the law enforcement professionals in the state. So that is, to me, an indication, if they're doing it voluntarily and it's, you know, that large majority, that it's a system that is, you know, easy to implement and work with. There's another FBI report that some might be familiar with called the Uniform Crime Report, and that's how we get the statistics around other violent assaults and sexual assaults. The departments that aren't reporting into this use of force are reporting into the Uniform Crime Report. And so the way, you know, it's been characterized is, you know, they're already doing that particular system. So, you know, adding this additional piece of reporting won't be burdensome. In addition to that, the FBI provides training modules on how to implement this, and then the department is available to support in a technical capacity any law enforcement agency that might need support for implementation. So I think, you know, it is important that kind of training be available, so, you know, people have those resources necessary and don't have to create something, you know, reinvent the wheel, so to speak. So that exists. So that I think is really helpful. And then the fact that the others are doing the uniform crime report, I think, you know, gives me confidence that they're familiar with the FBI reporting systems and then, you know, could more easily implement this one. In the prior year, there were, of the participating agencies, there were 13 reports that were submitted. So, you know, out of the last couple on this list are more recent, I'm told, of the 21 listed there. So, it, you know, would be the first 19 or so that would have been included in that prior year. And out of those, there were 13 reports, and mostly from the two largest agencies, which would be the Alaska State Troopers and the Anchorage Police Department. That's as much as I can offer, but we do have the person who, you know, works with this data at the department is much more familiar, and I, you know, I think it'd be a great opportunity if we wanted to get a response from her as well.
Okay, through the chair, that might be helpful. I guess an explicit concern is that if will this impose an additional burden on the uniformed police officer, or does this start from the administration department within the police department, is a specific concern. In other words, is somebody creating the data now, and is this just a new way of collecting and aggregating the data, or will this require generating new data from the source, the boots on the ground?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, in Section 1 of the bill, it does direct the Police Standards Council to develop the regulations around this reporting. So, you know, in that sense, it would become more standardized on the statewide level. As we shared with the list that's voluntarily participating, the FBI, that handout we shared, you know, has the particulars of what they're interested, you know, what qualifies for that reporting. So, you know, they would be using that, but then there'd be the alignment once the Police Standards Council created their, you know, the statewide regulations for Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Final?
Yes, go ahead.
Just a comment that personal experience again. We spent more and more time reporting and doing paperwork, and then there was less and less visits from the centralized office. It was a spread out company, and I would encourage somebody to take a look at that. Would it make more sense to just hire somebody and run around, see what's going on at the production level? In this case, the policemen driving around in their cars and what have you, walking around on the streets, might be more revealing.
For the record, Lisa Pernton, Alaska Department of Public Safety. I'm the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau Chief. Thank you for the questions, Prox. Through the chair, to answer the specific questions you had asked earlier regarding the additional burden on the sworn officers. With this reporting program, it's been our experience, as with the uniform crime reporting, that the sworn officers are not the ones. Thank you. Thank you. The sworn officers are not the ones actually doing the data entry for this. This is usually going to be administrative or clerical staff that is already reviewing the incident reports that the officers generate as part of their routine business, so it's not an additional duty. These are the incidents that they're already creating for other law enforcement purposes, and the administrative and clerical staff are usually the ones that are reviewing those, and then they would be entering this data into the crime statistics reports, or they would be entering it into the use of force database.
Okay, thank you.
Representative McCabe and then Representative McCarty.
So just a comment more than anything, the cops are already doing the reports, and the data is being pulled off of there by clerks, so it doesn't really impact the street officer. The problem I see with not collecting this is I see this as defensive. You have a really good police department, good leadership, they're honest, and something happens on the street one night somewhere and gets overblown by the news media, and all of a sudden this police department becomes the boogeyman, so to speak. If they have the data that says, no, we're not really the boogeyman, we've had some use of force issues, and here they are, and we can lay out the true data by what we're learning from an oftentimes emotional media, then we can counter it and say, no, this police department is actually a very good police department, has very good leadership, and here's the data to prove it. And so I think it's important that we collect that data. And I'm pretty satisfied. We've gone through this now for 3 meetings, and I've talked to Ms. Howell and the AST, and I'm pretty satisfied with the way this was written and that they've answered all our questions. So I appreciate the opportunity to be involved, actually.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. That I have now more questions, including that of boogeyman. So I have the same concern, and I like the intent, but how to make it happen without intruding upon the officers in the field and intruding upon the clerical, you know, production and whatever, getting this done. In a different field of mental health, I know of facilities that it's no joke, about this high, you know, about 3 feet high, a paperwork of reports that need to be, you know, entered that weren't, and some person was supposed to be entering that and just way behind. The question I have at this is the twofold with, you know, or prox, is the concept of the time-space continuum. And it seems that in our technology that we're asking people to multitask in a manner, and are we pushing the envelope of the time-space continuum to do something? I know that sounds like Star Trek or whatever, but to do something, and each little request saying, well, it doesn't take much, it's just a little bit of your time, but that little bit of time, little bit of time, pretty soon it's so consumed that the person can't keep up with it, and yet the demand is there. And I'm concerned that our system for doing this is, one, not making it available to make it happen effectively, and the paperwork is piling up. Two is that our humanity of processing things, that we are, you know, can't just quickly make that shift, and we're asking that officer to make a shift in, you know, to make sure the safety of people and protection of such from documentation. So that's a concern. And I know here in the Capitol, we are very busy. And I just started dictating on my phone, you know, as I'm walking down to go grab a sandwich to get something to maybe you. Mm-hmm. And it's like I'm maximizing my time, space, continuum. But people often are, I know I'm a geek, you know, I could walk and dictate, you know, I could read and walk and stuff like that. So now I'm mindful that I'm not going to trip on that curb, you know. But not everybody's going to be able to do that. You know, and we don't certainly want our officers to be in harm's way that they're trying to do something, driving down the road to go to somewhere, and they're requested to do reports. You know, that's the concern there. The second part was brought up is this, I'm going to get back to the boogeyman concept, but is this also creating a situation of learned helplessness in our officers, where they're afraid to act, apprehensive to be ready with deadly force, resulting in the death of the officer? And we're hearing of officers that are being killed, and there's bad boogeymen out there that don't give a rip, and they'll take down anyone, even our beloved officers. Mm-hmm. And because this, is that going to create a situation where they're going to be apprehensive, and then we've lost a civil servant?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to through the chair to Representative McCarty. So on the first point, you know, what I can say is, you know, just what I've kind of shared before, we know that 80% of the law enforcement professionals are voluntarily participating. And so, you know, that gives me some confidence that it's been easy to implement and not burdensome, because absent any requirement to do it, they've already chosen to voluntarily participate. You know, in the case of the departments that aren't participating now, you know, that was why I asked questions around, you know, is there training available? Is there support for implementing it? And so, yes, there are FBI training modules available, and there's support from the department. You know, once this becomes the requirement, you know, any technical support questions, you know, they would be available to ask that. So, you know, that's the second thing. In terms of the officer's behavior, this doesn't direct them to do anything, you know, differently. I mean, I think, you know, they would default to their training. And that, you know, from what I know, having done ride-alongs, is, you know, the training is pretty specific about, you know, your response to a dangerous situation and, you know, or, you know, all of these different things. We had someone, was it possible DUI, you know, you call a second officer in Anchorage for backup. That's part of the protocol. So, you know, I think we can expect their professionals, you know, they care about public safety, their own safety, the safety of their colleagues. So I think we can expect that they would continue, you know, making the right decisions. What we're trying to understand more about by the reporting of it is just, you know, what are the circumstances under which these incidents are happening? Because in the end, as you mentioned, you know, officers get killed, civilians get killed. You know, in both circumstances, there's an opportunity to understand better what happened and prevent that casualty on both sides. You know, that would be an improvement for public safety and a definite improvement for our officers. You know, we think about, you know, who are the people that go to work? And when you go to work, you might not, you know, you go to work that day, you might not come home. That's a big ask, in my opinion. That is a big ask of our public safety professionals to do that. And so when we have opportunities to understand better, you know, what's happening and improve safety for them, for the community, you know, I think that's the big win for all of us. And that's really, you know, the foundation of the proposed policy here. And as I understand it, you know, the FBI's interest as well, because, you know, again, what they're trying to do when they, you know, collect data is, you know, understand the trends, and then, you know, we respond to those. I know in other public safety things that I've worked on, in particular on domestic violence and sexual assault, you know, we use those reports all the time to understand, you know, is the prevention work, having an impact? Is the, you know, sentencing having an impact? You know, you're using that data to see the trends. And I can say as a compliment to this, and, you know, it came up in conversations here, you know, I know that across the state, public safety professionals are engaged in training on de-escalation, you know, specifically to provide more tools, you know, for those circumstances to try and, you know, not get to the deadly end result, again, for the officer or the civilian, because it's just not good for any of us, right? I mean, we don't want to see officers getting hurt or killed, and, you know, and then the public, you know, there's interest in what happens when civilians are killed. So anyhow, I can just say that that's the, you know, premise of this is to improve safety for both the public safety professionals and the community, and accomplish that by understanding more of the circumstances under which, you know, these things happen. Yes, please.
Thank you, Reptar. Again, for the record, Lisa Perrington, Department of Public Safety, through the chair to Rep. McCarty, the concern about the additional burdens and certainly the stacks of paperwork and the mountain of administrative support that goes to support those sworn officers for doing what they're doing. I just wanted to mention that there is currently in state law a requirement to report crime statistics data. So this would just be adding on to that statistical reporting that they're already required by law to do. It's just this added piece. And I agree with you, the extra 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there does add up. But because this is a narrow scope for the FBI's definition, there is the majority of these are going to be what we call a zero report. They had no incidents that qualified for the month. And so it's a very quick process to say, I had nothing for January. And it's as simple as that to go and enter that into the database so that all 12 months are accounted for.
Follow up with that.
Representative McCarty.
So in the system of reporting, is that do we have something that propagates to the different entities that's asking for that, whether it's DEA or the FBI or whatever, but they don't have to do the FBI report and the DEA report and this report. They just one report they do, and it just automatically goes out to that?
Through the chair to Representative McCarty. Unfortunately, currently, they do have to go into the FBI's database to do that. We are exploring the option to make it a one-stop shop to reduce that extra burden of going into the FBI's database to enter it so that they would just report it at one place and then we would report it up. We, being the Department of Public Safety, would report it up to the FBI.
Okay.
Representative McCarty.
And with that, are we doing a correlation study in this database to see, one, we're looking for deadly force and issues of incidents of that, but two is instance where things got out of control. And let's say, for instance, the concern of officers being afraid to use deadly force results in whatever that. And in my mind, you know, I was there I was doing grad work, but also worked for the Red Cross. And one of my friends was the son of Bob Vernon. He was the deputy chief of police of LAPD. And when the LA riots took place, he set the command strategy for LA. And Maxine Waters says, you cannot do that plan in South Central LA. There are 438 arrests that night in all of LA except for South Central. And we know all hell broke loose that night. I was there in Long Beach, the left. And when I came back an hour and a half later, 200 buildings were on fire, and it was just craziness, you know. So it was a situation where officer told you can't do this type thing, you need to stand down. And I'd hate to see if we're doing a correlation study, then I appreciate to hear that study a year from now, 2 years from now, you know, what's going on. So is that going to be happening in this?
Through the chair to Representative McCarty, this is a fairly new reporting requirement. It just went live with the FBI in 2019, and so they are working nationwide to get agencies to come up to a threshold of reporting. I think they're right at 60% of the law enforcement agencies in the country are covered in this use of force reporting. So the analysis of what's going to be produced out of the various data elements that are going to be collected is still a bit of an unknown. So I can't say 100% what a correlation study would be, but based on the data elements that are being collected, that is something at the state level. We will have that data, and we can certainly look into ways to produce that information to a certain level so that we're not, so that it's still a de-identifying process, but being able to provide some good statistics out of the data.
Appreciate it. And one more thing.
Go ahead.
Is that of getting back to the boogeyman and that of the media. So my understanding, when something happens, it's not immediate release because there's an investigation. In the FAA, a plane goes down. We don't know the results for maybe a year based on the NTSB, you know, studies. Is that the same expectation that you really, even though we collect the data, there's an investigation, all this stuff, the news is going to do its thing, and we may not see the results for a year?
Through the chair to Representative McCarty, the expectation for this FBI's database to report is they would like it reported shortly after the incident occurs. There's several options in the database to allow for an unknown or pending investigation for that data to at least be on the record, so to speak, in the database. And then as the investigation evolves and more information becomes available, then the agencies would be expected to go back into the database and update those unknown or pending investigation variables.
Okay. So the question is, like,
follow up.
Thank you.
Is this the one more? Not sure how that data collection's going, because we've heard a lot of one more. Bad enough. Which is what's important about data. If you don't collect all the data, it's not an accurate picture.
That's exactly right. Thank you. See, she could ask the questions too. So that of if our officers, police force, troopers are doing the rightful things, that I want to make sure that we are, you know, screaming out good job, rather than they keep on getting hammered and, you know, the system has to say, hey, they did everything right. Mm-hmm. And so I want to make sure this is happening, I guess, more of a statement than mm-hmm. question, but we got to give that ability to. Mm-hmm.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'd just like to correct the record for Representative McCarty. It's space-time continuum, and it's from Back to the Future, not Star Wars or Star Trek, just so you know.
And I guess I wanted to interject, and correct me if I'm incorrect. This is collection of data. It's not deciding whether use of force was justified or not justified. It is simply the data collection. As you know, that's sort of step one to draw other things. I look at this list of 80% of law enforcement agencies in Alaska are doing this, but I'm just looking through Southeast and going, Haines is participating, but Skagway isn't. These are communities that are 12 miles apart. Mm-hmm. And are you getting a real sense of, you know, let's just assume you've got an uptick in deadly force in one community, but you don't have data from the other community at all. So you don't know whether there's a shared criminal activity network. Mm-hmm. You know, that it would be helpful to have accurate data across the state, mm-hmm. both for justification of do we need to increase certain kinds of training or deployment of, but unless we have the data, and we, you know, we use that phrase a lot around here, we want to make data-driven decisions, but if we know that we've only got 60% reporting across the nation, and right now we've got 80% of Alaska law enforcement, we still don't have accurate data to tell us much. Mm-hmm. What we do with that data is entirely different. And, you know, I was thinking of, well, wouldn't the uniform crime report capture it? And then I immediately came to a circumstance here in this community a couple weeks ago that made the press where deadly force was used. It was a self-harm claim, a man who was threatening to harm himself. He called the police department in that, so no crime had been committed, but in the response, deadly force was deployed. No one was injured, but it wouldn't be captured in the uniform crime report because he wasn't charged with a crime. A crime wasn't, the police were responding. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any discussion that it was inappropriate deadly force, but that data needs to be collected. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it happened to be collected in the press currently. And I see that my police department is participating, so I'm sure they've collected it. And I am confident that my police chief has done some kind of staffing analysis of the full police response. And I don't for a minute think that it's my job to delve into to figure out who the officer was or why I wasn't there. But what I know is we want to make sure that that data is collected and we see if there are patterns around it.
Mm-hmm. So thanks, Co-Chair Hannon. So that brings up a really good point. I envision that this could be used, say, with spice. I mean, you're a little bit familiar with the effects of that drug on human beings. And so if you have an increase in the use of spice in a community and the deadly force that's needed to combat that also increases, I mean, you can put the correlation together, mm-hmm. and say, wow, this drug is really bad because it's creating the need for use of force in a police force that didn't used to have to do that. Or mm-hmm. I see a correlation. I see a way that these can be used in many different data-driven discussions and I don't disagree as long as it doesn't impact the police officer, mm-hmm. because they got enough to do with their, you know, surrounded by the MDT and everything else. But I think what you're talking about is classifiers, like APD has a whole team, I think, of like 12 classifiers, and that's all they do is these reports. And so, anyways.
All right.
Another editorial comment, sorry. At least it wasn't about movies.
All right. Any more questions or comments from the committee? Or Ms. Tarr? Representative Tarr, excuse me.
No, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to thank the Department of Public Safety and Department of Corrections for their help. And then also thank you, Representative McCarty, because I think it's important that, you know, we do sort of close out the discussion on this, affirming our support for our law enforcement professionals and the important job they have in our, you know, in our state and our communities. I'm very thankful. When I go door to door, the one thing I hear is just in my neighborhoods wish there were more police because sometimes the response time is slower than people would like. And so, you know, I think that is just another indication of the high value that my neighbors have on, you know, the law enforcement folks in our area. And I think that's shared, you know, across the state. And it's, you know, definitely one of those services you're so thankful exists, but you hope you never need, right? But it's important that we acknowledge that contribution and the commitment they make for all of us every single day. So thank you for, you know, bringing those things up so we could close out the comments with that. Thank you.
If there is nothing further from committee members, I'll entertain a motion. Representative Schwagi.
Co-Chair Hannon, I move House Committee Substitute for House Bill 256, Work Order 32-LS1341/B from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, we'll just take a minute to sign the report before we adjourn. And our next House Community and Regional Affairs meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, March 22nd, 8 a.m. Representative Shragi will chair next week, and we will be back with the Department of Corrections. They're not getting a break from us. Mm. And I'm going to go ahead and gavel out, and then if you all stay to sign the report, and we will be gaveling out at 9:27.